ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On the 3rd of May this year, Anthony Albanese achieved what many thought was impossible, a resounding, trouncing, thumping election victory that delivered 94 seats for Labor in a House of Representatives of 150. It near decimated the opposition and sent the Greens backwards. It's led to a period of fracture, soul-searching and division within the coalition that has not ended. It may end up with a permanent split. Time will tell. How did Anthony and Albanese achieve this in the face of polls and predictions that said the government was in trouble, that opposition leader Peter Dutton was on a roll, that Mr. Albanese was finished? Long-time Canberra observer Nikki Sava has written a compelling account of the campaign in her new book, Earthquake, the election that shook Australia. Nikki's been around politics a long time as an advisor to former Prime Minister John Howard and Treasurer Peter Costello, and as an authoritative columnist. She is insightful. She's written, I think, five books now, including masterful accounts of the prime ministerships of Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison. And she joins us tonight. Nikki, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
It's a pleasure to have you too. A lot of people wrote Mr. Albanese off, didn't they? And I'm not sure about you, but in December 2024... just last year, actually, you said that even if he won the forthcoming election, he should retire. And it was a pretty pungent column that said so. What do you think now?
What journos always say, right? When I wrote it, it was right. And it looked as if he was either going to lose or end up in minority government. And it would have been the first one-term government in almost a century. And he was off his game. There were issues that he would allow to run for, you know, sometimes weeks at a time without addressing them. And people inside the Labor Party were naturally very concerned. And it was clear to me that he either had to shape up or ship out. And, you know, they were really in the depths of despair. And they admitted that to me both at the time and then after the election even. So he got his act together over the summer period and in the lead up to the new year. He began talking agendas, what policies they should be offering for the next term, if they were lucky enough to get there. And he got his head straight. And it was really as simple as that. I mean, it was essential, but it was, you know, vital. It was absolutely vital that he do it.
As you record in your book, he fronted up at the National Executive of the ALP in November last year and said, I think we could win 80 seats, to which people were politely, you know, spluttering into their coffees or whatever they had. And everyone thought he was off his rocker.
They literally were laughing to one another later, saying how ridiculous, you know, as if that's going to happen. And he also had a dinner at the end of the year in his electorate, and he said something similar that, you know, you might think I'm crazy, but, you know, I've got a plan. And everybody was thinking, oh, yeah, I can't wait to see that, including, you know, one of his best friends, Darcy Burns, said to me, you know, he thought they were goners. But, you know, he worked at it and did whatever he had to do. And I must say, it was a very well put together campaign, both in terms of policy offerings, in terms of strategy, and also in the way that the campaign itself was conducted.
I suppose I was one of the things that puzzles me is that is you know was all this in Mr. Albanese's head? I mean, those around him were equally gloomy. The polls weren't good, and Mr. Dutton, and we can talk about this in a moment. Mr. Dutton perhaps got a bum steer off this. He thought he was riding high. In fact, he probably wasn't. But certainly, the polls for Labor weren't that good. But when the campaign began, all of a sudden there's a well-oiled machine. And I suppose I'm puzzled here. Was all this in Mr. Albanese's head? Did he know what was about to unfold in terms of the Labor rollout? Or were he and Paul Erickson, the National Director of Labor, in such close communication that they were the only ones who knew that it was going to be all right?
They were in very close communication, and Paul Erickson, and I do say this in the book, he's really a campaign mastermind. Mm. I mean, he's an extraordinary talent for the Labor Party to have, and, you know, if I was the Labor Party, I'd never let him go.
Talk to me about that. Why is he so good?
Why is he so good? Well, he thinks of everything, right? He plans well. He's got very good political instincts. He's trusted by everybody, which is, you know, vital inside Labor, as you know, which can be very highly factionalised and conflict-ridden. But he is trusted across the factions, and he's just extremely smart. He knew from the middle of last year what they had to do to win another term, and he was as worried as everybody else inside the party about whether it was all going to come together or not. But he and Albanese have very close rapport, and around about November last year they started the planning. And can I say, I first kind of realised that Paul Erickson was quite smart, very smart, at the by-election for Eden Monaro when they were in opposition. And they won that by-election against the odds. And one of the reasons was because Erickson ran such a good campaign, including down to the postal votes. They won it on postal votes, something that Labor had never really been good at. But he made sure absolutely everything was covered.
Yes, no. One of Mr. Albanese's favourite statements to interviewers, I mean, he's said it to almost everyone I've read, is that people always underestimate me, he said. He apparently used this line to Mr. Dutton when Mr. Dutton rang him to concede on the election night. He said, "See, you underestimated me." And he says this a lot. He said it after he got elected the first time. People underestimate me. What do you think?
Well, he could be right. He could be right about that. Maybe we did underestimate him. Look, this election was won by Albanese decisively and lost by Dutton comprehensively, right? Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just one or the other, it was the two things together. Albanese did campaign very well. He didn't make any mistakes this time. He won all the debates. You know, he was across his brief, and he had thought ahead as to how he might be able to snooker Dutton, and it worked a treat. And that began with announcements in very early January, including, you know, $7 billion here for the Bruce Highway, Medicare emergency clinics, bulk billing announcements. And every time he made an announcement like that, Dutton had no choice except to say, "Me too." Yep, I'll do that as well, right? And it got to the point where Dutton had promised to do all these things, like bring in a better budget bottom line, cut spending even further, and fund nuclear power stations. And there simply wasn't the money to do it, including on budget night when Labor announced a small tax cut, but a meaningful one. And Dutton decided that they weren't going to match it because, you know, it was a piddling little tax cut for starters. But secondly, they'd run out of money and he wanted to spend more on defence. Mm. But it meant that Labor, for the first time in its history, went to the election as the party for lower taxes.
Mm. I'm talking with Nikki Savva, the author of The Election of Earthquake, The Election That Shook Australia. And if you wanted to know what happened at the last election, this is your go-to book. You probably don't need to read much else about it. Nikki, why was the coalition, you pointed to tax. Well, in fact, let's talk about tax for a moment, because I mean, I just wanted to have a conversation about why the coalition was so short on policy, and in particular policy detail, and whose fault it was. But tax seems such an obvious one that you go into an election campaign with a thought up or thought out tax policy. You can't afford not to. And in this instance, the coalition didn't seem to have one. They flirted, as you write in your book, interestingly, about announcing tax indexation, which would be a terrific thing, as every rational person knows, but does cost money because you've got to keep yourself honest. And, you know, Peter Dutton thought about it and then said no. But then inexplicably, Labor announces a small tax cut, which isn't that great. But inexplicably, Peter Dutton opposes it. And, you know, I think it wasn't Malcolm Fraser years ago who said, I learned a bit of lesson. You never go into an election campaign promising anything other than taxation, other than a cut. Or maybe it was John Howard. But this was the thing. It seemed inexplicable that he would oppose a small tax cut for everyone.
Well, it really shocked people. Mm. It really shocked Liberals to the core that they would do something like that, and they couldn't understand why he had done it. I couldn't understand why this had happened. Mm. You know, I was, you know, watching on budget night like everybody else, and you know, heard him and Angus Taylor say that they weren't going to support it. Then even worse, the next day they said they would repeal it. And I thought, these guys have gone completely bonkers. You know, fancy going to an election promising to repeal a tax cut. But nevertheless, that is the path he chose. And then when it was obvious the next day that, you know, people were very anxious about this inside the coalition, they put together the fuel tax rebate. And that was, you know, one of the few policies that they had in the campaign. And it was kind of put together at the last minute because they had to come up with something.
Mm. Whose fault was this? I mean, you're in your book, you point to Peter Dutton's office, that Peter Dutton was reluctant to take advice widely, that he trusted very few people, that, and even in his office, there's a very curious instance at one stage of Alex Dalgleish, his chief of staff, calls together the policy advisors in Mr. Dutton's office, in foreign affairs, in, you know, in tax, in health, and so on, and says they're to come up with novel policy ideas, but they're not to contact their shadow ministers about it. I mean, it's almost verging on paranoia, was it?
Well, this is how the office was described to me subsequently. They were secretive and paranoid. And there was no trust, you know, between Dutton and his most senior shadows. And, you know, when I thought about it later, I realised all the people that he was close to, that he had been close to in Parliament, had all left. Matthias Cormann had gone, Christian Porter had gone, Stephen Chobo had gone. So he had really no confidants inside the parliamentary party. And then he, I think, was suspicious of the motives of, you know, some of those around him, like Hastie and Angus Taylor. And so that, I guess, heightened his own insecurities. But also, you know, there was this view that because they had so comprehensively destroyed the Voice referendum, that they could use the same tactics against Albanese in a general election without, you know, stopping for a moment to think. They were two completely different things, right? People were voting for completely different reasons. One was an election about the cost of living, right? And the other was a vote to change the constitution. And, you know, you could get away with completely negative tactics on the constitutional question. You could not do that in a general election on the cost of living. It was not enough to just criticise or condemn what the government was doing. You had to come up with your own solutions to the problems that people were facing. And they never really did.
Yes, it's clear from your book that that's right, that there was, that the Voice did, it got them off balance. They thought, well, that's all we have to do again, and we'll be right. But for the reasons you outlined, that was a mistaken notion. Why was, just getting back on policy though, there's been suggestions since that, you know, opposition front benches weren't doing any work, and that, for that matter, Peter Dutton wasn't the hardest worker either. Is you quote some people, many people in the book, saying he wasn't that keen on working on weekends, wasn't that keen on working that hard. He himself has suggested that, you know, some opposition front benches like Andrew Hastie weren't pulling their weight. Were front benches pulling their weight, do you think? Or was there even then a juggling going on about who was coming next?
Well, they insist, the shadows insist, that they had policies ready to go. But even if they didn't, I mean, it's the job of the leader and the leader's office to say or to insist or to lay out an agenda, right, and say, these are the issues I want you to address. I want you to come up with policies that, you know, to fix housing, or I want you to come up with policies that, you know, that reduce the tax burden on people. And, you know, then you insist that the work be done. But according to people that I spoke to subsequently, well, one was Karen Andrews. She described Dutton as Mr. 80%. That is, he never gave it his all, not in the campaign, not when he was challenging Malcolm Turnbull, and not when he was challenging her for pre-selection for the seat of Moncrief in Queensland when he wanted to shift to a safer electorate. You know, he'd always, you know, kind of skive off, go off to dinner or whatever. And even Tony Abbott was highly critical after the election about the conduct of the campaign. He thought it was a disgrace, and he was saying to people that he didn't know whether Dutton never truly wanted it. Or whether he wanted it badly enough. Well, I think there is something in that. I mean, you know, it's not a small thing to be running for Prime Minister, right?
No.
To lead the country. And if you really want to get there, you have to do absolutely everything, right? Direct everything to that end. You work every single day, you surround yourself with the best people, and you take their advice. You know, if the campaign director says to you, you know, we want you to be a bit, you know, a bit softer, you know, maybe poke fun at yourself and not having any hair and all that kind of thing. Well, these are things you have to do, right? But he never seemed to give it 100%. He would disappear at weekends. If there was bad news around, you wouldn't see him for days. He would never come out to advocate or to explain.
What do you think about the issue of him, of Mr. Dutton personally? The Griffith University ANU survey of elections, which they do each one, pointed to, you know, the personal popularity of Mr. Dutton as a big factor here. You yourself say, look, you know, he had an appearance that, well, look, this is not his fault, but an appearance that wasn't immediately warm and engaging, and that his embrace of, well, that the public sensed that he was also on side with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is not popular in Australia. How important was that personal factor, that they just didn't like Peter Dutton, a big issue?
Well, it was. He was unpopular to begin with, and he was even more unpopular by the end of the campaign. And it wasn't just his appearance, right? His appearance was confronting. But, you know, no offence, but Anthony Albanese is no oil painting. John Howard was no oil painting. You know, we're used to having rather plain looking leaders, if you like. It's what they say and what they do that's equally important. And what he said sometimes was very unnerving for people, particularly when it related to Trump. You know, he began attacking revered institutions in Australia like the AEC, like the CSIRO. He was sidling up to Trump, you know, after Trump said he was going to turn Gaza into the Riviera. Dutton said, oh, well, that shows what a big thinker he is, you know, rather than, you know, an idiot. And when he finally realised that Trump was a negative and was going to cost him, it was too late. He had already, you know, tied himself to Trump, and then, you know, midway through the campaign, he stands alongside Jacinta Nampajimpa Price as she promises that he's going to make Australia great again. And Andrew Hirst believed that that was the worst day of the campaign for Dutton, because it just reminded people of the way he'd tried to connect with Trump, and Trump at that stage was frightening the hell out of people.
You make a point in the book that the coalition, in shifting to the right as they have done, were not representing a lot of modern Australia. The issue with Jane Hume's comment about Chinese students, for example, didn't improve things either. Was that a big issue, that too many people, migrant communities maybe in particular, felt the coalition wasn't on board with where they were at and their place in Australia?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. Keith Wallahan, who held the seat of Menzies, who was a small L Liberal, has a very high Chinese Australian population. And he was, I remember him saying to me, he was hanging on by the skin of his teeth after the whole working from home debacle, just hanging on. And then after Jane Hume's Chinese spies accusation, that was it. He was done for. So, yeah, people, you know, they watch and they listen and they think, these people don't seem to like us, or they seem frightened of us, or they're using us, you know, for their own political purposes. And it's a huge turnoff, obviously, clearly. And, you know, why the Liberal Party can't seem to grasp that is one of their greatest problems, I think.
What's likely to happen, do you think, Nikki? Because there's been suggestions that, you know, at the moment there's a lot of self-harm going on the coalition side. We've seen more today. Barnaby Joyce announcing that he's joining One Nation. Well, maybe no surprises there. There are suggestions that the right of the coalition might coalesce around a new coalition of right-leaning parties, One Nation included, that the Liberal Party could split permanently into its left and right, into its left and centre factions. Is there any possibility that a new embracing, genuinely Liberal centrist party of the kind that Menzies successfully put together and successfully managed for all those years could emerge, do you think?
Look, I think we're at a point where anything is possible. I don't think you can go through an election like they did in 2022 and, you know, in 2025. These were not, you know, just run-of-the-mill elections, right? They were catastrophic for the Liberal Party, absolutely catastrophic. And to think, as some people seem to, that it can just be business as usual is living in la-la land. I mean, something has to change. Well, no, sorry. Everything has to change, and it has to be dramatic, and I cannot see how things can stay as they are, because the differences between them now are so great, seemingly irreconcilable, and I think anything can happen. We could end up with one new party or two new parties who can't predict, really. But but I do think something big will happen as a result of this last election, because it was so meaningful.
Yes, you get that sense, don't you, that something big is going to happen. One of the things, I suppose, if you subscribe to these theories of about politics, is that, you know, powerful personalities change things as much as perhaps movements do, and that who is the personality that's going to step forward to do this? I mean, you get a sense that is Tony Abbott. He harbours a wish to come back, doesn't he? Do you think that's fanciful?
Not in the slightest. I think if the opportunity presented itself, he would jump at it. Yeah. But you know what, Tony Abbott showed that he was a brilliant opposition leader. He was very good at destroying, but he was lousy as a prime minister. He couldn't even make it 2 years as a prime minister. So somehow, I don't think Tony Abbott is the answer to their problems. And I'm not sure who is. You know, like you think of charismatic characters who can, you know, swing things around, and you think Nigel Farage. You know, as much as distasteful as he is and as his policies are, look at what he's done in the UK. Now, is there a Nigel Farage character here? Thank God, no.
Thank heavens. What about he's the perennial hope of the centrists, and that's just Josh Frydenberg. Now, he lost his seat to Dr. Monique Ryan, of course. You say in your book, he's been careful, though, husbanding the pre-selection vote there, and he'd win a pre-selection for the seat if he wanted it. He'd have to think, could he beat Monique Ryan? And if he did beat Monique Ryan, you know, enter the parliament again, what would he inherit, as it were? Would there be much of the house left? Where do you think he's sitting at the moment?
Well, I think he's sitting and waiting. One thing that they'll be waiting to see is whether the Liberals can win the Victorian election next year.
Hmm.
Now, they've changed leaders. She presents very well, Jess Wilson. She's articulate. She seems smart. And if she can't beat, or if they can't beat, an ageing incompetent government like there is there now, then they might as well pack up and go home. If she does win, then that will give them some hope that maybe they can come back. But the thing is, there hasn't been one thing that the Liberal Party, Federal Liberal Party, has done since 2022 that might appeal to voters in those teal seats that they lost.
Yes, in particular the issue of climate. They seem hopelessly riven on this, and is that presumably a centre-right split, is it? And those two sides seem hopelessly unreconcilable, don't they?
Well, they are. The thing with the moderates federally is that usually they raise the white flag, right?
Mm.
The thing about the right is that they do not stop until they get what they want.
Mm.
They fight and fight and fight and fight, and they end up winning each and every time. Now, the moderates haven't been able to do that for a very long time, so they acquiesce. And this is why it's easy for candidates in teal seats to run against, you know, whatever candidate the Liberal puts up, to say it's all very well you choosing this person, but you're really voting for, it used to be Barnaby Joyce, you're voting for, you know, the right wing of the Liberal Party. It doesn't matter what the candidate is saying, they will make no difference. And that's what Frydenberg will be up against at the next election if there is no change in policy and no tacking back to the centre.
Mm. Yes. Is there going to be a stampede following Barnaby Joyce to One Nation? One Nation are polling well at the moment. They're in the high teens in polling. But then again, polling is an election day, and they've never replicated this high voted on an election day. But do you think something has changed, or is this just discontent with the coalition?
I think a lot of it is discontent with the coalition. I think it's conservative voters who, I mean, the Liberal Party conservative base is also disintegrating at the moment. That's what we're seeing at the same time. The Nationals are losing support to One Nation, and the Liberal Party is either losing support to One Nation, or, as some others think, it's losing voters to Labor, because Labor has actually moved very close to the centre under Albanese. So, maybe a couple of others will drift off to One Nation as well. So, like I say, we're in a climate where anything can happen, and we shouldn't be surprised when it does.
Nikki Savas, my guest, I think, is unsurprised by anything in politics. Her new book, Earthquake, The Election That Shook Australia, is a comprehensive look at what happened in this remarkable election where Labor won 94 seats in a house of 150 and decimated the opposition and led to all the soul searching. That's probably too kind of phrase for what's going on inside the coalition. What do you make of the argument, Nikki, that okay, they did win all those seats, but they only won 35% of the primary vote and yet won 62% of the seats? And if you look at seat by seat, a lot of it is thin. I mean, it's, you know, it wouldn't take much to swing it back again.
Yeah, well, all that is true too. The Labor Party needs to be, and I think, you know, the smarter people are very conscious of that and cognizant. I mean, they're not... obviously they're very happy with the way things went, but they're not sitting around backslapping all the time saying, you know, everything is set now, their primary vote is still quite low, and they've got to try and bump it up as well. And I think, you know, that's one reason why Albanese tacks to the centre, which I think is, you know, is smart. But also, I think it would be a mistake on their part to think that if you start on major reform that you're in danger of losing ground. I always think that if you come up with good policies and explain them properly to people, people will understand and accept, and you actually improve your position. So it would be wrong for the government to be frightened off reform, to fear it, which you sometimes get the impression that they are.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned Jess Wilson in Victoria, but actually there are three new young women Liberal leaders now. They're all first-term MPs. To Jess Wilson in Victoria, as you say, is extremely presentable, articulate and smart on her feet. Kelly Sloan in New South Wales, of course, you would put in a similar judgment box, I presume, and Ashton Hunt in South Australia. So is it the start of a renewal at state level, if not federally?
Well, look, certainly in Victoria, that is their best chance of victory. Nobody, not one single person, thinks that they will do well in the South Australian election. No. Malinauskas is just so embedded there and so popular. You can't imagine him being knocked off. You can't even imagine the Liberal Party making up ground. So it's a last roll of the dice kind of thing, but which I don't think will get them anywhere, really. So they've kind of wiped off South Australia. And I also don't think that there would be much prospect of the Liberals winning in New South Wales. But if they win in Victoria, then they will, you know, that's something to cling to, right? Mm. They will have government in Tasmania, Victoria and Queensland. That's, you know, they've had worse times.
Mm. You're right about Susan Lee in the campaign, and there's a question that some raises whether she was ever fully on board, or was she campaigning for her own self, that is going around talking to people, shoring up numbers, etc. One, what's your view of that judgment of her, and two, do you think it's almost certain that she'll be replaced in the first half of next year?
Yes and yes. She was sounding people out before polling day about the leadership. One of the people she sounded out was Jane Hume. There was another person she sounded out who subsequently lost their seat. But in any case, it was clear that you know, she'd made a judgment that they were going to lose, and they would probably lose badly enough for there to be a challenge against Dutton. So she was getting ready to put her hand up. Plus, she campaigned in seats where she hoped people would be grateful to her later. And this did not go unnoticed by her colleagues. I mean, they were the ones who were remarking on why was she not prominent in the campaign. The most prominent woman in the Liberal Party campaign was Bridget McKenzie, and she's a National. It wasn't Susan Lee. So there was a lot of suspicion around about her, and that has created a lot of bad blood between the members of the right wing faction and her. And yes, she has made major concessions to the right, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much she gives them, how many concessions she makes. They're never going to vote for her. they will never accept her as leader of the Liberal Party as it is now. So, yeah, I think it's inevitable, really, that she'll be replaced next year.
So who replaces her? Is it Andrew Hastie? He seems, lonely figure, but he seems a figure on his own. He's obviously intelligent. He's got a good backstory to tell, I suppose. But he doesn't seem to have a lot of people around him. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And the other obvious contender is Angus Taylor, who, you know, you get kind of lukewarm receptions every time you raise him too. What do you make of these two candidates?
Well, I think if he was to move closer to the centre, I think Andrew Hastie is the standout candidate for leadership of the Liberal Party. When he puts his mind to it, and arrives at a position, he can be very persuasive on things. I'm not talking so much about social issues, but other foreign policy or defence issues, which was his area of expertise. And I sort of see him as a work in progress, but he said to me that he believes, he knows, that unless the Liberal Party changes drastically, it could become extinct. And it's his ambition, he says, to recreate the Menzian Liberal Party. But he sees his first objective as consolidating the Conservative base, which, as I said before, is disintegrating. So he thinks, and he's a bit of a strategic thinker, that he consolidates the base, and then once he secures that, he can then, you know, inch back to the centre. I wait to see. I think he's a work in progress.
One of the things that some people have remarked about that kind of analysis is that Menzies was very successful, but it was a very different Australia then.
That
the inner suburbs, I mean the big suburban centres of Australia where most of the population live, you know, now have people from all over the world, and it's not the same Australia. Not everyone knows Don Bradman's batting average anymore, and that's important.
It is a very different Australia, but Menzies, presided over the great post-war immigration program. I mean, I'm a product of that. And that was a period of great change for Australia as well, which was unsettling for a lot of people. But he managed to find, you know, the themes that would unite people, you know, things that people could coalesce around. And that's the challenge, I guess, for leaders today. And John Howard used to say this a lot, you know, we should concentrate on the things that unite us rather than divide us. But the modern Liberal Party these days, and Dutton did this in the final week of the campaign, right, the final week of the campaign, when there was still 15% of people undecided, Dutton ran two culture wars, one on welcome to country, which has become a very divisive issue, and another on the hate media, which was a very Trumpian song to play. So, you know, I mean, they should just forget all that, for heaven's sake, and just campaign and coalesce around the things that, you know, are going to improve the country and which accept the kind of country that Australia has become. I mean, sometimes you listen to them and you think they hate what Australia has become. That they, you know, have no truck with tolerance, for instance, or diversity. You know, they get hung up on, you know, whether transgender or gender issues, and you think, for goodness sake.
Which are very small issues in the scheme of things.
Small issues, yeah.
Mm. What about the net a whole net zero thing? Do you think this is a way forward for them, or is it just them circling the wagons over on the far right and that's all it is?
Well, part of it is circling the wagons. But, you know, I also think that at a time when people are still really worried about power bills and all that, that they could get traction with it. Mm. But what they don't have is an alternative. No. They don't have an answer. Right? They have a slogan, you know, affordability, sustainability, whatever it is, but they don't have the actual flesh and bones of a policy that will fix the problem.
Yep. Interesting. All right. Meanwhile, of course, Labor watches on, and the man who says everyone underestimates him, well, maybe we have to... have to consider it for a period of time. Nikki Saber, it's been terrific to talk. The book, your book, The Earthquake, it's called, The Election That Shook Australia. Get it for summer reading, because it's full of wonderful insights. And Nikki Saber's always one for saying where the information came from. Great one for naming sources. So you do feel as though you are truly on the inside as well. It's called Earthquake, The Election That Shook Australia. Nikki Saver has been our guest. Nikki, terrific. And happy Christmas. Thanks for talking.
Thank you, and the same to you and to all the ABC listeners.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.